Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're looking at a subject today that permanently altered the trajectory of modern conflict.
It really did.
Yeah, it's a moment in history where that rigid boundary between the digital domain and the physical world effectively just dissolved.
Right, completely vanished.
We are talking about a sophisticated piece of code that crossed the air gap to weaponize heavy industrial machinery. Our sole source for this analysis today is a really comprehensive Wikipedia article. It details the history, the mechanical execution, and the geopolitical fallout of the malware known as Stuxnet.
Which is a name that carries a lot of weight.
Oh, absolutely. If you follow cybersecurity at all, you already know the name. But today, we are going beyond the headlines to really dissect the architecture of the attack.
Digging into the actual mechanics of it.
Exactly. We're going to look at how it propagated, how it targeted specific hardware signatures, and how its discovery triggered a global cyber arms race that, honestly, we are still dealing with today.
It is a fundamental paradigm shift in threat modeling. Well, Stuxnet wasn't merely a sophisticated worm. It was the first widely documented cyber weapon to cause actual physical destruction of critical infrastructure.
Physical destruction, not just deleting files.
Right. Before this, the prevailing threat models for industrial control systems focused largely on broad disruptions or, you know, data exfiltration, just stealing information.
Yeah.
But the revelation of this code forced a global reevaluation of how we secure the invisible digital frameworks that control our power grids, our water treatment plants, and our manufacturing sectors.
Because suddenly the stakes were physical. So the mission for our deep dive today is to map that exact shift. We want to understand the mechanical reality of how a massive compiled file on a little USB drive navigated a highly secured environment to execute a targeted physical strike.
A very precise strike.
We are going to trace the forensic breadcrumbs from the initial discovery of the anomalous code all the way down to the resonant frequencies of the sabotaged hardware. Okay, let's unpack this.
To appreciate the technical audacity of the code, we really have to look at the landscape of threat intelligence back in the summer of 2010.
Right. Take us back there. What were researchers dealing with mostly?
Well, security researchers were accustomed to analyzing malware designed for financial gain or botnet proliferation.
Or just espionage, right?
Exactly. And that code was usually lightweight. It was optimized for rapid transmission over networks and designed to exploit widely known vulnerabilities just to get maximum infection volume.
Just spreading as fast as possible.
Yeah. But then in June 2010, this Belarusian antivirus company, Virus Blockada, they received reports from clients in Iran about computers caught in reboot loops.
Just constantly crashing and restarting.
Right. So a researcher there named Sergey Ulesin began analyzing the offending file. And the telemetry immediately indicated this was not a standard threat actor.
And the initial propagation vector itself was notable, right? Because it heavily relied on local physical transmission.
It did.
It wasn't primarily blasting itself across the internet via malicious email attachments or compromised web servers like we usually see. It was utilizing removable drives.
USBs.
Yeah, USB flash drives. The malware would infect a host machine and then aggressively replicate itself onto any inserted USB drive. It created this physical contagion model designed specifically to bypass network perimeter defenses.
Which is brilliant if you think about it.
But it was the sheer size and structure of the file that completely bewildered early analysts. The source notes the file was roughly half a megabyte.
Which sounds tiny to us today.
Right, but in the context of malware development.
Oh, it's huge. Operators pride themselves on microscopic payloads measured in mere kilobytes. A half megabyte binary is a behemoth.
It's massive.
It suggested a really massive compiled program carrying extensive internal libraries and complex logic trees.
And it wasn't just written in one language either. It was written in multiple programming languages, including C and C++, wasn't it?
What's fascinating here is the implication of that development environment. A multi-language, half megabyte compiled binary points away from like a lone wolf operator or even a small cyber criminal syndicate.
It looks corporate.
Exactly. It points toward a formalized software development lifecycle. It suggests distinct teams working on different modules.
Like a propagation team.
Right. A team handling payload delivery, a team writing the rootkit, and then all their work was integrated into a single massive payload.
But the size was merely the first anomaly, wasn't it?
Yeah, the forensic analysis truly escalated when researchers realized how the worm was achieving remote code execution.
Because it was burning an unprecedented amount of zero-day exploits.
Four of them.
Yeah, four. For you listening who might be familiar with the vulnerability market, you know the deployment of even a single zero-day is a huge deal.
A massive event.
Because a zero-day is an exploit for a software vulnerability that is completely unknown to the vendor. It's unpatched. Zero-days are the ultimate premium asset in cyber espionage.
They are incredibly expensive to discover, engineer, and weaponize.
Right, often selling for hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars on the exploit market. Standard advanced persistent threat groups might use one zero-day to breach a high-value target. But according to our source, Stuxnet deployed four separate zero-day vulnerabilities simultaneously.
Which is wild. Deploying four zero-days in a single payload is the digital equivalent of burning millions of dollars in black market research and development in a single strike.
Just lighting the money on fire.
Pretty much. Because the moment those exploits are used in the wild, the clock starts ticking. Security firms will capture the code, vendors will issue patches, and the exploits will become completely worthless.
So to willingly burn four at once signals an attacker with virtually unlimited resources.
Right. Aiming at a target of such extreme strategic value that the loss of the exploits is considered an acceptable operational cost.
Let's examine the specific vulnerabilities it leveraged, because the technical implementation was devastatingly effective.
It really was.
It utilized a vulnerability in the Windows Print Spooler service for local network propagation. But the most aggressive vector was the LNK, or PIF, Windows Explorer exploit, designated as CVE-2010-2568.
And this wasn't a vulnerability that required a user to run an executable.
Right.
Or open a macro-laced document.
No, the vulnerability existed in how the Windows operating system parsed the metadata of shortcut files.
The tactical advantage of that LNK exploit cannot be overstated, especially for an air-gapped environment.
Explain that a bit more for the listener.
Sure. So in a typical scenario, an operator might plug a USB drive into an engineering workstation. Merely opening the folder to view the contents forces Windows Explorer to render the icons for the files.
Just to show what's in the folder.
Exactly. But the malicious LNK file was engineered so that the mere act of rendering its icon executed the malware payload in the background.
Wow.
It was essentially a zero-click execution. The human operator didn't have to make a mistake. They didn't have to click a bad link, they just had to look at the contents of the drive.
That is terrifying.
The malware also leveraged vulnerabilities previously associated with the Configure Worm, which ensured broad compatibility across unpatched legacy systems.
And beyond the exploits, the attackers needed to ensure the malware could install its drivers deep within the Windows operating system without triggering user account control warnings. Or alerting endpoint security software.
Right, it had to be invisible.
To achieve this, they compromised the public key infrastructure itself. The source details that the malicious rootkit drivers were digitally signed with legitimate, stolen private keys from two highly reputable hardware manufacturers, JMicron and Realtek.
And both of those companies were located in a specific science park in Taiwan.
Right.
The compromise of those digital certificates is a critical element of the tradecraft. The Windows operating system relies on certificate authorities to verify the integrity of software.
So if Windows sees the Realtek signature,
it trusts it. If a driver is signed by a trusted entity like Realtek, the operating system kernel accepts it as legitimate, benign code. By stealing and utilizing these specific private keys, the attackers ensured their rootkit could load its drivers directly into Ring Zero.
Which is the highest privilege level of the operating system.
Exactly. Completely silently. The user receives no security prompt. The antivirus software, seeing a valid signature from a trusted hardware vendor, just waves it right through.
Which means obtaining those keys likely required either a highly sophisticated network intrusion into the corporate networks of JMicron and Realtek in Taiwan, or actual physical espionage to extract the keys from their secure facilities.
Both are incredibly difficult to pull off.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the architecture of Stuxnet, once it successfully installs itself, reveals a hyper-specific mission profile. It is not designed to destroy everything it touches.
No, it's very picky.
The source breaks the malware down into three distinct modules. There's a worm designed for broad execution and environmental checking. A link file responsible for propagating copies of the worm, and a highly advanced rootkit whose sole purpose is to obscure all malicious files and running processes from both human operators and diagnostic tools.
This modular design highlights the fundamental tactical challenge the attackers faced breaching an air-gapped network.
The air gap.
Right. Industrial control systems managing critical infrastructure, particularly those involved in sensitive national security projects, are not connected to the public internet. They are physically isolated.
Meaning you can't just hack them from a laptop in another country.
Exactly. The initial infection must therefore occur on internet-connected networks, and the code must wait patiently for a human vector to bridge the gap.
It relies on SneakerNet.
SneakerNet, yeah.
An engineer infects their personal laptop or a general-purpose workstation. The worm moves onto a USB drive. That engineer eventually physically walks into the secure air-gapped facility and plugs that USB drive into an engineering terminal connected to the industrial control network.
And just like that, the air gap is breached.
But what is remarkable is the sheer volume of collateral infections it generated versus the actual damage it inflicted. The worm was highly prolific in its spread. It jumped across local area networks and removable media, yet it remained entirely benign on the vast majority of infected machines.
That benign behavior was a deeply engineered constraint to maintain operational security. If the worm caused system crashes or degraded performance on every computer it touched, it would have been immediately flagged by IT administrators worldwide.
It would have been analyzed and neutralized before it ever reached its intended target.
Right. So to mitigate this risk, the developers implemented strict internal governors. The code was hard-coded with a self-destruct date. It was programmed to erase itself entirely on June 24th, 2000.
Literal expiration date.
Yeah. Furthermore, a single infected machine was restricted from infecting more than three other machines. It was designed to slowly, methodically saturate an environment without triggering volumetric alarms.
And while it was sitting on thousands of random machines, it was constantly running an environmental checklist. It was acting as an incredibly precise targeting funnel.
A funnel is a great way to describe it.
It didn't execute its destructive payload unless a very specific set of conditions was met. Let's trace the logic of this targeting funnel, as detailed in the source, because it really demonstrates the profound intelligence gathering that preceded the code's development.
It's layer upon layer.
First, the worm checks the underlying operating system. It requires a Windows environment.
Okay.
If that check passes, it moves to the second layer. It scans the system for the presence of Siemens Step 7 software.
Now, the requirement for Siemens Step 7 software is the first real indicator that Stuxnet is hunting for industrial infrastructure. Step 7 is a widely used engineering software suite designed to program and monitor programmable logic controllers, or PLCs. The PLC is the critical hardware component in an industrial setting. It is the embedded computer that takes digital logic from the Step 7 software and translates it into physical actions.
Like opening valves, regulating temperatures, or adjusting motor speeds.
Exactly.
So if the machine does not have Siemens Step 7 installed, the worm essentially goes back to sleep.
It just waits.
But if it finds the software, it initiates a man-in-the-middle attack on the local machine. It intercepts the communication protocol, specifically the Profibus connection between the Step 7 software running on Windows and the actual Siemens S7 PLCs connected to the network.
By intercepting this communication, the malware gains the ability to interrogate the attached industrial hardware. Which brings us to the third layer of the targeting funnel.
Right.
The malware interrogates the PLC to determine the exact make and model of the variable frequency drives attached to the system.
And variable frequency drives are essential for controlling the rotational speed of electric motors by varying the frequency and voltage supplied to them. Industrial facilities use thousands of these drives for pumps, conveyors, fans.
But Stuxnet was not interested in standard industrial drives.
Not at all.
The code explicitly queried the PLCs looking for frequency converter drives manufactured by only two specific companies, Vaken, which is based in Finland, and Ferropaya, based in Iran.
So specific.
Very. If the drives on the network were manufactured by Siemens or ABB or literally any other vendor, the malware aborted its payload.
Even if it found the Vaken or Ferropaya drives, it still wasn't ready to strike. It moved to the final, most restrictive layer of the funnel. It began passively monitoring the operational frequencies that those specific drives were outputting to the attached motors.
Just watching and waiting.
Right. It was programmed to only unleash its destructive payload if it observed the motors operating at exceptionally high speeds. Specifically, sustained frequencies between 807 hertz and 10,210 hertz.
That frequency range is the definitive operational signature of the target. Standard industrial motors, whether in a water treatment plant or an automotive assembly line, They just do not operate at continuous frequencies between 807 and 1210 hertz.
That's too fast.
Way too fast. Those extreme speeds are specifically required by gas centrifuges used in the isotopic separation of nuclear material.
Wow.
The rotors inside these centrifuges must spin at supersonic speeds to effectively separate the heavier uranium-238 isotopes from the lighter uranium-235 isotopes.
So the attackers knew the exact hardware vendors supplying the target facility, and they knew the exact operational parameters of the centrifuges.
The intelligence they had was flawless.
When all of those exact criteria were met, Windows OS, Siemens Step 7, Siemens S7 PLCs, Vakin or Foropaya drives, and sustained frequencies above 807 hertz, the digital weapon finally executed its physical payload.
The trigger is pulled.
It ceased being a passive observer and took active control of the frequency converters. The source details the physical mechanics of the sabotage, which is just crazy. The malware would periodically override the PLC logic and force the centrifuges to spin wildly out of control, pushing the operational frequency up to 13,410 hertz.
This extreme overspeed condition subjected the delicate aluminum centrifuge rotors to massive mechanical stress. The physics of gas centrifuges are incredibly unforgiving.
They operate in a vacuum, right?
Yes, spinning on magnetic bearings at speeds close to the absolute material limits of the metals involved. When Stuxnet pushed the frequency to 1410 hertz, it likely drove the rotors through specific resonant frequencies. Those are the critical speeds where the natural vibration of the machine amplifies.
Which is bad.
Very bad. Passing through these resonant frequencies without careful control causes catastrophic wobble. But the malware didn't just overspeed the machines. After pushing them to 1410 hertz, it would aggressively slam on the brakes, drastically reducing the frequency to just 2 hertz.
The sudden deceleration from supersonic speeds down to a near halt, followed by a ramp up back to normal operational speeds, induced catastrophic torque and vibrational stress. The aluminum tubes literally tore themselves apart.
Just shattered.
It destroyed the structural integrity of the cascades and contaminated the vacuum environment with processed gas and debris. But the brilliance and the terror of the attack lies in the rootkit functionality we discussed earlier. As the machinery was physically destroying itself, the operators sitting in the control room were completely unaware.
Right, because the man-in-the-middle capability of the rootkit was deployed to execute a devastating psychological operation against the plant engineers.
A psychological op.
Yes. Prior to initiating the destructive frequency changes, Stuxnet would record roughly 21 seconds of normal, stable operational telemetry from the PLCs.
Like a bank heist movie looping the security camera feed.
Exactly like that. Once the attack commenced, the rootkit intercepted the actual failing sensor data coming from the dying centrifuges and fed the pre-recorded loop of normal telemetry back to the Siemens Step 7 monitoring software.
So the monitoring screens in the control room showed everything operating perfectly within parameters, green lights across the board. The operators had no digital indication that the cascades were failing until they physically heard the machine shattering or the mechanical safeguards hard trip the power.
This forces a terrifying cognitive dissonance.
I can't even imagine.
You are an engineer in a highly secured facility. Your screens, which you are trained to trust implicitly, tell you the system is stable. Yet the extremely expensive, delicate machinery you are responsible for is failing at an unprecedented rate.
Before anyone suspected a highly advanced cyber weapon, the engineers likely spent months questioning their own competence.
Suspecting flawed manufacturing in the centrifuge parts or blaming operator error, it was designed to create chaos and organizational paralysis.
So what does this all mean? We have an unimaginably sophisticated digital weapon armed with 4 zero-days, stolen certificates, and deep industrial logic, engineered specifically to hunt down and physically shatter gas centrifuges operating at very specific frequencies. The source provides the crucial geographical context for this.
Yes.
In August 2010, the security firm Symantec published a geographical heat map of the global infection vectors. The data revealed a stark reality. Approximately 50% of all infected hosts globally were concentrated entirely within Iran. The target was the Natanz nuclear facility.
Now, before we go further, we need to pause for a second here.
We do. Because the sources discuss some heavily politically charged geopolitical conflicts, specifically regarding the United States, Israel, and Iran.
Right, and we need to make it incredibly clear to you listening that we take no sides here. We don't endorse any actions by any country.
Exactly. We are strictly reporting the claims, the forensic footprint, and the historical consensus exactly as they are meticulously documented in the provided Wikipedia text. We are just analyzing the evolution of the technology and the documented global response.
Operating strictly within that framework, we must analyze the resource requirements necessary to develop a weapon of this caliber. Cybersecurity experts and intelligence analysts widely concluded that a project of this magnitude could not be the work of a non-state actor.
It couldn't be a couple of hackers in a basement.
No. Symantec estimated that developing the code would have required a dedicated multidisciplinary team of 5 to 30 highly skilled software engineers, vulnerability researchers, and industrial control experts working for a minimum of 6 months.
Not to mention they would need a physical mock-up of the Natanz centrifuge cascades to actually test the payload.
Right, which effectively demands state-level resources and vast intelligence-gathering capabilities.
The media investigations and expert consensus detailed in the source heavily point toward a collaborative effort. Major publications, most notably detailed reporting by the New York Times, classify Stuxnet as a joint U.S.-Israeli cyber weapon. The reports allege that the malware was developed under a highly classified, expansive intelligence initiative codenamed Operation Olympic Games.
The source notes that this aggressive cyber campaign was reportedly initiated during the administration of President George W. Bush and was subsequently accelerated and expanded under President Barack Obama.
And the specific intelligence agencies frequently identified by analysts in the text reflect the dual nature of the weapon.
The United States National Security Agency, the NSA, alongside the CIA, are cited as providing the vast software engineering resources, the zero-day exploit, the overarching architectural framework.
Right.
Meanwhile, Israeli intelligence, specifically Unit 8200, the elite cyber warfare and signal intelligence division of the Israel Defense Forces, is cited as providing the hyper-specific operational intelligence regarding the Natanz facility.
Because they needed to know the exact setup.
Exactly. The theory posits that Israel provided the exact hardware manifests, the network topologies, and the precise rotational frequencies required to calibrate the attack, potentially even testing the payload against physical centrifuges at their own nuclear facility in Dimona.
The source also highlights moments where this covert operation seemed to breach the surface of public awareness. A notable anecdote involved a retirement video created for the head of the Israel Defense Forces, Chief of Staff Gabi Ashkenazi.
The Daily Telegraph reported on this.
Yeah, they reported that during a celebration of his operational tenure, a showreel was played that allegedly included direct references to the success of the Stuxnet operation, heavily implying institutional pride in the deployment of the weapon.
But the code itself also provided researchers with a series of cryptic breadcrumbs embedded directly in the binaries.
Forensic analysis of the decompiled code revealed several embedded strings and dates that immediately sparked intense speculation regarding attribution. The presence of these internal markers highlights the complex psychological layer of malware analysis.
The most heavily scrutinized artifact was the presence of the word MYRTUS embedded in the project file paths within the code.
MYRTUS, which triggered immediate wide-ranging geopolitical analysis. Some researchers argue that MYRTUS, the Latin botanical name for the myrtle tree, was a clear cryptographic signature.
Because in Hebrew, the word for myrtle is Hadassah, which is the birth name of the biblical Queen Esther of Persia.
Right. And given the biblical narrative of Queen Esther saving the Jewish people from a Persian plot, many analysts viewed the MYRTUS string as a poetic, almost arrogant signature left by Israeli intelligence.
However, as the source notes, industrial control experts offered a much more grounded, technical explanation.
Yeah, the engineers looked at it differently.
Very differently. In the context of SCADA systems, MYRTUS could easily be interpreted as an acronym for my RTUs, meaning my remote terminal units, which is a standard hardware designation in industrial programming.
It could just be a boring file name. There was also a specific numerical value hard-coded into the execution logic, Reverbal 19790509. Analysts immediately correlated this to a specific historical date, May 9, 1979.
This was the date that Habib Elganian, a prominent Jewish businessman, was executed in Tehran following the Iranian Revolution.
While these clues heavily suggest an Israeli origin, analysts must approach them with extreme skepticism. In the realm of advanced persistent threats, attribution is notoriously difficult.
Experts from Symantec explicitly caution in the source text that attackers of this sophistication routinely employ false flags. Leaving a trail of culturally specific breadcrumbs pointing directly at Israel or the U.S. could be a deliberate counterintelligence strategy.
Designed to mislead forensic analysts and manipulate the geopolitical narrative.
Exactly. When you have the capability to write a half megabyte of undetectable weaponized code, typing the word MYRTUS to confuse your adversaries is a trivial effort.
It's too easy. Yet despite the untraceable nature of the zero days and the deeply obfuscated code, deploying the weapon into a completely isolated network ultimately required human intervention. The digital weapon relied on traditional human intelligence, human, to bridge the final physical gap.
The sneaker net.
Right. The source brings up the role of a Dutch engineer named Erik van Sabben. According to intelligence reports, van Sabben was allegedly recruited by Dutch intelligence, working in coordination with the U.S. and Israel, to infiltrate the Nathans facility.
The reporting suggests that he utilized his engineering background to bring the infected equipment, potentially a contaminated water pump, or simply the infected USB drives directly into the plant.
The inclusion of van Sabben grounds the abstract nature of cyber warfare in stark human reality. The source notes the tragic and highly suspicious circumstances following the operation. Just 2 weeks after the Stuxnet payload was successfully deployed and the centrifuges began failing, Erik van Sabben died in an apparent single-vehicle motorcycle accident in Dubai.
Whether his death was a tragic coincidence or the result of counter-espionage operations remains heavily debated, but it certainly underscores the immense physical risks involved in deploying these digital assets.
But despite the vast intelligence apparatus, the careful physical infiltration, and the incredibly restrictive targeting funnel designed to keep the worm hidden inside Nathans, the weapon eventually escaped.
It did.
And the catalyst for the world discovering Stuxnet was not a brilliant counterhack by Iranian defenders. It was a simple, mundane programming error.
The architecture of the worm was designed to ensure it remained localized to the intended target and eventually deleted itself. However, the source indicates that an update to the worm's code introduced a minor configuration error.
A bug.
Just a bug. This error altered the propagation logic just enough to allow the malware to spread beyond the air-gapped environment. An engineer working within the Nathans facility connected their laptop to the infected industrial control network.
The worm, operating as designed, replicated onto the laptop.
Right. The failure occurred when that engineer subsequently removed the laptop from the secure facility and connected it to the public internet. Because of the programming error, the worm did not recognize it was outside the target environment.
So it failed to remain dormant.
It aggressively reached out, utilizing its zero-day exploits to spread from the engineer's home network across the global internet.
That single moment of reverse infiltration from the air-gapped facility back out to the public internet ignited the global cybersecurity response. Once the code hit the wild, antivirus firms worldwide began capturing the binaries.
Symantec's global telemetry map didn't just highlight Iran anymore. The heat map showed significant infection clusters in Indonesia, India, and Azerbaijan.
The aggressive propagation of the LNK exploit meant it was blindly jumping across massive corporate and municipal networks. The source notes a particularly alarming claim by Eugene Kaspersky, who stated that the worm successfully breached the networks of a nuclear power plant in Russia.
The infection of the Russian nuclear plant demonstrates the inherent volatility of self-propagating cyber weapons.
You can't control it once it's out.
While the Russian facility was heavily isolated from the public internet, preventing the worm from receiving external commands or spreading further, its presence inside another nation's nuclear infrastructure highlights the terrifying potential for unintended escalation.
The targeting funnel prevented Stuxnet from destroying the Russian plant because the specific Siemens hardware and centrifuge frequencies were absent. But the breach itself proved that the weapon was capable of violating the sovereignty of unintended targets.
The public revelation of Stuxnet and its capabilities had immediate cascading consequences across the geopolitical landscape. It functioned as a massive wake-up call, effectively kickstarting a global cyber arms race.
Iran, realizing the extreme vulnerability of their critical infrastructure, rapidly reorganized and heavily funded their national cyber warfare capabilities. They shifted from a relatively defensive posture to highly aggressive retaliatory operations.
The source documents several major suspected Iranian cyber responses. In 2012 and 2013, they allegedly launched Operation Ababil. This was a massive, sustained, distributed denial of service campaign targeting the external networks of major United States financial institutions, causing massive disruptions.
But the retaliation extended far beyond DDoS attacks. The escalation reached a critical point with the 2012 deployment of the Shamoon malware against Saudi Aramco.
The Saudi Arabian National Petroleum and Natural Gas Company.
Right. Shamoon was a destructive wiper malware. It didn't attempt to quietly manipulate industrial controllers. It was designed for brute force destruction of data.
It successfully wiped the hard drives of approximately 30,000 corporate computers at Saudi Aramco, replacing the data with an image of a burning American flag.
The source also notes a highly destructive attack in 2014 against the Las Vegas Sands Corporation. Stuxnet essentially signaled to the world that critical infrastructure and major corporate entities were now legitimate, active battlegrounds.
And the original architects of the code were reportedly attempting to replicate their success elsewhere.
A Reuters report cited in the text indicates that the NSA attempted to deploy a modified version of Stuxnet to sabotage the nuclear weapons program of North Korea. However, that parallel operation ultimately failed.
It didn't fail due to a flaw in the code's logic, but rather due to the operational environment.
North Korea's extreme isolationism.
Exactly. Their rigorously air-gapped networks and the near-total lack of standard sneakernet crossovers meant the intelligence agency simply could not find a human vector to physically introduce the malware into the facility.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the forensic analysis of Stuxnet over the subsequent years revealed that it was not an isolated weapon. It was rather one component of a massive, heavily resourced cyber espionage ecosystem.
Security researchers mapping the architecture of advanced persistent threats eventually identified a cooperative umbrella of malware platforms. They referred to this as the G-Lusk Girl framework,
which linked several highly sophisticated threat actors, most notably the Equation Group, which is widely believed to be tied to the NSA.
The source notes that within this framework, researchers discovered several distinct malware families, including Flame, Duka, and Flowershop.
And these share deep architectural similarities, zero-day exploits, and code libraries with Stuxnet. They were essentially sharing an open-source framework for nation-state cyber warfare.
Duqual, for example, is described as Stuxnet's cousin. It utilized a nearly identical modular architecture and rootkit design, but instead of carrying a destructive payload targeting centrifuges, Duqual was engineered purely for deep network reconnaissance.
It logged keystrokes, captured system configurations, and exfiltrated architectural data, likely laying the groundwork and mapping the networks for future Stuxnet-style physical attacks.
And Flame, an incredibly massive and complex espionage toolkit, directly shared USB propagation modules with early variants of the Stuxnet worm.
The discovery of this shared ecosystem proved that the intelligence agencies had developed a highly industrialized pipeline for cyber warfare. But the programming error that allowed Stuxnet to escape NATANS ultimately dismantled the exclusivity of that pipeline.
Once the binary was in the wild, the world's most capable reverse engineers, both in commercial security firms and rival intelligence agencies, decompiled the code.
They took it apart.
They analyzed the zero days, they studied the man-in-the-middle rootkit techniques, and they mapped the industrial control subversion methods. The source code, the operational blueprint for the weapon, was eventually published online.
And that reality defines the true lasting legacy of the operation. The source quotes Michael Hayden, the former director of both the CIA and the NSA. When assessing the impact of deploying Stuxnet, he stated, "They opened the box. They demonstrated the capability. It's not something that can be put back."
The fundamental architecture of Stuxnet is not inherently limited to Iranian gas centrifuges. The logic framework, the ability to remain totally hidden from the Windows kernel, the capacity to hijack local industrial communication protocols, and the capability to feed fabricated telemetry to human operators is entirely modular.
The blueprint is highly adaptable.
Extremely adaptable. With modifications to the targeting funnel and the specific PLC payload, the exact same architectural concepts could be deployed to manipulate the variable frequency drives on a municipal water pump.
Or alter the safety thresholds in a petrochemical refinery.
Or disrupt the robotic assembly lines in an automotive plant. The attack proved, unequivocally, that you do not require a kinetic weapon or a physical saboteur to inflict catastrophic damage on an adversary's critical infrastructure. You only require access and the right sequence of compiled code.
It is a sobering realization regarding the fragility of the systems we depend on. To trace the massive scope of what we've unpacked today, we started with the discovery of an unusually large half-megabyte binary spreading indiscriminately via USB drives. We analyzed how it deployed an unheard-of 4 zero-day vulnerabilities and stole cryptographic certificates to bypass perimeter defenses and remain entirely invisible to the operating system.
We walked through the incredibly precise targeting funnel designed to cross the air gap and hunt down specific models of variable frequency drives spinning between 807 and 1210 hertz.
We explore the devastating physical execution, forcing the centrifuges at Natanz to tear themselves apart, while the rootkit fed perfectly normal data to the blinded plant engineers. We navigated the complex geopolitical attribution, linking the code to the U.S. and Israel under Operation Olympic Games, the mysterious embedded clues, and the tragic intersection with human intelligence.
Finally, we examine the fallout, the programming error that unleashed the code onto the global internet, sparking a retaliatory cyber arms race from Iran and exposing the highly modular framework of nation-state malware to the entire world.
The history of Stuxnet takes the highly abstract concepts of digital security and zero-day exploit markets and grounds them in terrifying physical reality. It demonstrates that the screens we look at are no longer barriers. They are highly vulnerable conduits to the physical world. The concept of securing a facility now requires defending against invisible logic just as rigorously as defending the physical perimeter.
This raises an important question, and it is reality I encourage you, the listener, to critically analyze as we conclude our deep dive today.
What's that?
Well, we have comprehensively detailed how a targeted digital weapon from 2010 possessed the capability to successfully infiltrate, subvert, and physically destroy machinery inside a highly secured, heavily monitored, air-gapped nuclear facility.
Right.
Considering the vast advancements in artificial intelligence, automated vulnerability discovery, and the proliferation of nation-state tools over the last decade, what highly obfuscated, perfectly dormant code might be sitting silently right now inside the critical infrastructure that you rely on? The municipal power grids, the local water purification plants, or the regional hospital networks that keep you alive and safe every single day?
That is a profound and genuinely unsettling thought to leave on. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. We love unpacking these complex systemic topics with you and exploring the mechanisms that shape our modern world. Keep questioning the systems around you, keep learning, and we will catch you on the next one. Take care.